Thank you. May it please the court. Nicholas' right to counsel is the right to effective assistance of counsel, regardless of whether that right derives from statute or from the Constitution. This court has said that he has a due process right to counsel, which vests at the time the state of Missouri filed the petition for a civil commitment. Under the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause, the right to counsel is the right to effective assistance of counsel. We know that from cases like McMahon versus Richardson and the early cases about the right to counsel in the United States Supreme Court. Other SVP states have found the same, like Ontiveros in Kansas, cases from Virginia and South Carolina. But even states with SVP commitment that have not yet recognized the constitutional right to counsel have recognized that the statutory right to counsel has a correlative right to the effective assistance of counsel. In Missouri, we've seen that happen with termination of parental rights cases. Courts across the state have said that the statutory right to counsel implies the right to effective assistance of counsel, otherwise that right is an empty formality. And the same is true in this case. The legislature could not have given Nicholas and other men accused of being SVPs the statutory right to counsel and have intended these people subject to involuntary commitment to have counsel who is prejudicially ineffective.
I'm sure you will, but you'll distinguish for us the post-conviction. The fact that in post-conviction cases, the courts found it's not.
Yes, Judge. This is very different than post-conviction cases. These are original proceedings. They're not collateral. At the time that Mr. Grotto and the other men accused of being SVPs are being prosecuted by the Attorney General's office under a petition to civilly commit them, they're a brand new lawsuit. It's an independent civil action, and while there is an underlying criminal conviction, that's an evidentiary issue. This isn't a direct and collateral consequence of a criminal conviction.
But how do you distinguish these kind of cases from civil contempt proceedings?
These are more similar to civil contempt proceedings than they are to PCR cases.
And in civil contempt proceedings, the U.S. Supreme Court has said there's no automatic right to counsel.
Correct. I believe that was in Turner. But the court went on to look at several factors, one of which was the opposing state represented by counsel? A balancing test. And in that situation, when the government is represented by counsel, providing counsel to the indigent individual who's being subject to the prosecutorial power of the state is appropriate. So we have that situation here. And then in Missouri in civil contempt cases, we have cases like Lane that have said because actual imprisonment, and in this case imprisonment through confinement at the Department of Mental Health would result, the due process clause requires the appointment of counsel. So whether it comes just from statute or whether it comes from a substantive due process right required of fundamentally fair trials under the 14th Amendment, or we do a procedural analysis under Matthews versus Eldridge, the result is the same. There is a right to effective assistance of counsel, and it has to mean something. Counsel would be meaningless. It is the right through which all of my client's other rights are effectuated. It doesn't matter if the state follows the proper procedures if there's not someone standing beside my client to advocate for them and to insist that those are followed. It would do no service to require the expense of appointing counsel and let counsel be prejudicially ineffective.
So how do you determine whether counsel is prejudicially ineffective then? What standard should this court use if we were to buy and accept your arguments?
This court should apply the Strickland standard. Nearly every type of civil commitment case that has addressed an ineffective assistance of counsel claim has done so, whether or not they've found a constitutional right or merely a statutory right. There are at least 10 other SVP states that do so, and I've read cases from 15 other general commitment states that have done that. The only states that I'm aware of that don't follow Strickland when evaluating ineffective assistance of counsel in civil commitment states, formerly Montana. Montana had a standard that was lower than Strickland, so more difficult for the state to prove counsel was not ineffective. But in 2017, in a case called Matter of JS, the Supreme Court of Montana reversed that, and they now apply Strickland. And New York applies a state standard, which is not as stringent as Strickland at well. There are a lot of...
Would that require, though, some type of procedure for an evidentiary hearing at the trial? level to determine whether or not there was effective assistance of counsel?
Yes. I think the real issue before the court is how are we going to litigate ineffective assistance of counsel claims? The state and I seem to agree by our brief that direct appeal is not an appropriate forum because there isn't a way to develop factual claims. And
but
there's
we deal
not
with, that's how we deal with it with parental termination cases. Isn't that correct? We
Pardon?
Base it off, we do that with parental termination cases. We do it based on the record.
So far, it's been on the record, and the cases that have addressed ineffective assistance of counsel in those cases have been very clear to say we haven't needed to develop a procedure yet. But in one case, CMVR, this court even noted that perhaps one mechanism might be to appoint a special master or develop a way to remand to the trial court for additional fact-finding. And if this court believes that litigating ineffective assistance of counsel claims on direct appeal is the best avenue, then the next step would be to determine what procedure would we apply. Would we appoint a special master? Would we remand it?
If we proceed with ineffective assistance of counsel and limit, if we accept your claim and then get to litigation, if we do it only on the record, we're limited to what occurred during the hearing, not any representation of counsel before the hearing.
Correct.
And so that's a limitation that has been criticized in TPR cases.
Yes, it has been criticized in TPR cases. It's been criticized by the United States Supreme Court in some other contexts as well. I believe the Massaro case from 2003 points out that it can even be a waste of time and more efficiently done in a collateral review mechanism. I have personally been able to identify some examples of egregious ineffective assistance of counsel that my clients have received, but it's not on the record. And so at this point in time, I haven't had any ability to raise it. I have been limited to raising what I can identify from the transcript.
What's the statutory, assume for sake of this question, that there is a valid claim for ineffective assistance of counsel in these cases? Where's the statutory obligation for the public defender to bring those claims?
Well, the SVP Act itself identifies the right to counsel in all of the proceedings, at least three different points.
Well, I understand that. I'm assuming that for purposes of the question, that there was one in the, that there's a right to counsel for the SVP proceedings, but this is a separate action, separate civil action is the way I understand it for ineffective assistance of counsel. In the post-conviction area, we have a court rule that provides for appointment, but I'm not aware of any court rule or statute that would obligate the public defender's office to appoint counsel to bring an ineffective assistance of counsel claim during an SVP case.
Thank you, Judge, for clarifying. I now understand. There is a provision for the right to counsel in SVP actions on direct appeal, which is why that we have brought them here so far. In terms of like 24035 or 2915, at this point in time, they don't include civil commitments. They would be limited to criminal cases. And so what I am asking in both of these cases is that there's an expansion of those rules. The public defender system is prepared to incorporate any PCR of SVP cases within the PCR divisions that we already have. We anticipate there would be about 12 cases a year where we might pursue an effective assistance of counsel or other type of PCR claims. And because it's this court's rule, this court has the ability to expand that. However, there's not a specific rule that would say we could bring a collateral proceeding otherwise. We would have a statutory right to bring a habeas petition. Individuals who are confined in the Departments of Corrections have the specific statutory rights to that as well as the provisions of Rule 91. Well, however, there are also some impediments.
But does the SVP, would they be within the Department of Corrections?
I'm sorry, the Department of Mental Health.
Okay.
Thank you, Judge. So other states that have expanded habeas rights to do ineffective assistance of counsel claims, the Supreme Courts of those states have directed that the SVP litigants would be entitled to counsel at the first habeas petition. And if this court believes habeas is the best avenue, we would request then that the court announce a rule that counsel would be provided for the first round of habeas so that someone would have a legitimate chance to challenge the effectiveness of counsel.
But some of the states that have said that they're entitled to effective assistance of counsel, isn't that a different procedure, different postural procedure? Aren't some of those states like Kansas a direct appeal?
Kansas would allow an IAC claim on direct appeal or through habeas, but Kansas has a statutory mechanism for remand during direct appeal and to stay the direct appeal until there were fact findings in the trial court. And right now we don't have that. The other states that allow claims on direct appeal, I know Minnesota in general civil commitments does, but again, there's a special court rule that permits the district court to grant relief on a motion to vacate or on direct appeal. Idaho has said there's no other procedure, and where a record is sufficiently clear, it can be on direct appeal. But again, we have some of the same problems about raising claims of ineffective assistance on direct appeal. If it has to be preserved in a motion for a new trial, trial counsel is unlikely to do that. There are also cases about the likelihood of bringing an ineffective assistance of counsel claim against someone's colleague. As it stands now, there are five attorneys in the state who handle SVP cases, and we all work together and collaborate on all of them. So I may not see an example of ineffective assistance of counsel because I worked on the litigation direction of the trial itself, and then I'm representing that individual again on appeal. And
so
I'm
you're saying they have to be a special office like there is?
I think that is the best way to do it. That gives impartiality and some objectivity.
But that's something internal to the public defender's
office. That's something that would be internal to the public defender system that we've already worked out, but I think it's significant for the court to know that we are prepared to take on an effective assistance of counsel claims through PCR and our PCR office.
So I was going to ask how often the same counsel represents the person on appeal as representing them in the trial court, but you're saying even if that were different, it wouldn't avoid all the conflicts.
I believe that's true, Judge. There are some reasons why habeas isn't great for us in Missouri. We can bring successive habeas petitions and bring them in perpetuity at any point in time. Some of the other states that litigate IAC claims through habeas have definite time periods in which that claim must be brought, and we don't have that. I think the best example of another SVP state...
Counselor, you're out of time.
Oh, I am. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Mr. Grotto's argument fails for three reasons on the basis of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. The claim cannot be brought on direct appeal. Appellant is claiming a non-existent right, and this is the wrong case in which to decide this issue. I'd like to begin with why this is inappropriate for direct appeal. The appellant has actually abandoned his claim that this is appropriate on direct appeal. Counsel just did it in oral argument and in the reply brief, that this is the wrong case. And as appellant is asking this court to take action in this direct appeal case,
I think counsel's saying this is the only avenue and it's inadequate.
I'm sorry.
I think counsel was saying this is right now the only avenue to raise it and it's not adequate to that purpose. But it says there's no other avenue, you're saying you simply can never bring an ineffective assistance claim.
I would argue that for appropriate determination of this case, at least a habeas case would have been a better avenue. There is a provision, a statute that says that those who are incarcerated in the, or not incarcerated, I'm sorry, committed in the Department of Mental Health can bring habeas cases. So for a claim like this, that would have been the more appropriate route. Direct appeal is an appropriate, appellate concedes that, and here we are asking this court to litigate from the bench and essentially create a new Supreme Court set of rules or create something that specifically says that they can raise this in habeas, even though they have that option right now.
Judge Powell mentioned we do this in termination of parental rights. You do raise it on appeal, and you probably have to since we consider it on direct appeal to preserve it. Why wouldn't that be sufficient here, and wouldn't it be important to try that at least to make sure you didn't waive your right?
Yes. An appellant has tried it here, and we've seen the failings. Judge Wilson actually raised a really good point in Goldsby versus Lombardi case recently in oral argument about the problems with raising an issue for the first time in the appellate courts, and that's the lack of record. There's no record developed here. First of all, the claim wasn't even preserved in the motion for a new trial. Second of all, we have some conflict issues with whether counsel can raise those issues even in a motion for a new trial. There's no evidentiary record at all made. Because it wasn't raised, there was no hearing on it in the motion for a new trial hearing. So there's a complete dearth of facts in the record here.
If we are looking at what time and what's the appropriate proceeding, it seems that a motion for new trial is not a very effective avenue, because clearly you're going to have the same counsel that you had during the trial.
That's correct. Yes. So that didn't happen here, and nor would we expect it to, because a direct appeal is not an appropriate avenue. Habeas also has issues, and we're certainly not conceding that there is a right, but we do want to acknowledge that direct appeal is not the appropriate venue, particularly since this is a special statutory proceeding with a limited right to counsel. The provisions for counsel are very small. It's just at the PCR or at the PC hearing, and then at the trial, and then on appeal, and it just says representation by counsel. So it's a limited right to begin with, and then the appeal statute actually is very specific that appeals are limited to the determination as to whether someone is a sexually violent predator. It doesn't mention any sort of collateral attack like ineffective assistance of counsel, so it's outside.
Well, how do we know if they were properly convicted if they had ineffective counsel? That's necessary for defending on that very issue, isn't it? I noticed in your brief you said that all they can raise is limited to whether the determination was proper, but if they had ineffective assistance of counsel, then how do we know if it was proper?
It's commitment rather than conviction. Because the legislature chose to use language specific to the determination as to whether someone is or isn't, I think that...
Why you think that doesn't include ineffective assistance. If you had ineffective counsel, then doesn't that undermine the determination? It may be a proper one, but how do we know if you didn't have effective counsel?
There's a general, I think, distinction between direct appeal and post-conviction attacks, the collateral attacks that are based on the type of counsel that was provided as opposed to the actual sentence and conviction in criminal cases or commitment order in these cases, which are just the underlying sufficiency of the evidence, trial court error, those kind of things. I think this court's jurisprudence has kind of divided those issues into two different segments.
Can you address the suggestion we should develop PCR rules or expand the current PCR rules rather than using habeas, because there's no clear right to counsel in habeas, and because having structure and time limits might be better in this situation were we to recognize that right?
I think that's an attempt, again, to get this court to legislate from the bench. The legislature could have written into the law, which is very thorough as far as due process protections and procedures, both through probable cause, trial, and appeal. They could have chosen to write in a collateral attack provision, but they did not.
So do you think our 2403-5 and 2915 are improper and we shouldn't have them, you're telling us?
No, because...
Or are they codification of our inherent statute, habeas corpus authority?
Both are true. It is a stem off from habeas, but they are put in place, presumably, to affect Strickland and the United States Supreme Court precedent to recognize the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. That's not the case here. There is no constitutional right to counsel here.
Well, Section 632.498 says that SVPs should be afforded all constitutional protections. So what constitutional rights does an SVP have?
Sure. There are constitutional rights, I think, that protect procedural due process for committees, and they're all listed throughout the statutes. The right to counsel is included. Appellant cites a lot of case law about the right to counsel and how that's necessary to protect due process. Missouri complies with that. We have a right to counsel in our statute. It's a limited right to counsel.
But if it's not an effective counsel, isn't that a hollow right?
No, Your Honor. It's a limited right to counsel here. And the effectiveness, that whole doctrine, is based off of the Sixth Amendment. It was very difficult to even find any case law that talked about ineffective assistance of counsel as the term of art that we recognize it in civil cases, because it all kind of stems from the Sixth Amendment.
But there's a lot, no, they're in the variety of states that have been talked about in both briefs, there are many states that have recognized the right to effective assistance of counsel. And it's based on the liberty interest and the that is being affected here if you're committed for an extended period of time as a result of the determination that's made. I know you recognize there's a liberty interest, but you say it's not fundamental. Can you explain that to us?
Yes, Your Honor. Clearly, with a commitment, there is a liberty interest at issue. But it's not a fundamental right. And I've talked about in my brief the Eighth Circuit decision in Carson citing to prior United States Supreme Court precedent about whether commitments, civil commitments, are impinging on fundamental rights. And the answer was no. Because if we trace our history back, civil commitments are well-established and well-rooted in our jurisprudence.
And are you asking us to overrule three of our own cases to hold with what you just said?
I did ask this court to re-examine the cases in Norton and their progeny about strict scrutiny versus rational basis review, yes.
Was that dicta in Norton, or was that part of the holding?
I read it as being part of the holding, but if this court certainly finds it was dicta, then I would ask this court to make that clear.
Was it the holding in the two cases or three cases that then followed it?
I think it was less clear in the two cases that followed than Norton. I believe the language is the strongest in Norton. But yes, this court should re-examine its finding that this act is based or should be reviewed by strict scrutiny and is based on a fundamental right, because it is not. And the other states that have found these rights to ineffective assistance of counsel proceedings are kind of all over the place. Some of them are merely based on their state statutes. Some of them find constitutional rights, certainly not the Sixth Amendment, but some sort of amorphous due process interest. Some use Strickland, some do not. Some have provisions based in their statutes or in their rules, some do not. And they're really all over the place. And so I would not ask this court to follow the other states, because there's really no solid reason that they've articulated that this court can adopt. We're sitting here on direct appeal. It's not an appropriate venue. It's essentially asking this court to provide an advisory opinion here, because appellant has already stated that this is not the appropriate venue to raise this claim. There's no record available that we can even discern this, although on the merits of it, there's no ineffective assistance of counsel here. And appeals here are statutory and are limited to a determination. I'd like to talk about procedural due process. I think it's important, if this court does recognize there's a due process right here, that we look at what's already in the statute. And the sexually violent predator statute is lengthy and very, very detailed. The amount of protections that they already have clearly meets procedural due process here. We have probable cause hearings. We have multiple reviews by experts before the probable cause hearing and after, provisions for at least two other examinations that can go on a trial and a unanimous jury, and the right to counsel at different points. So because of that, the statute clearly meets procedural due process in this case. And just having an extra provision that the legislature did not intend to incorporate would be unnecessary here. As far as the termination of parental rights cases, I'd like to distinguish that from the court. There was one question about that. Those are different because they do impinge a fundamental right. The right to your children is a fundamental right, and that's been recognized and by the Supreme Court, this court. And even in those cases, they still don't use Strickland. Strickland is an easy kind of out because it's the way that we can conceptualize an effective assistance of counsel. But, of course, it's based on the Sixth Amendment. So even in termination of parental rights cases where this court has found that there is a right to effective assistance, there's still no use of Strickland there.
So I don't know if you're saying this, but if we were reluctant to overturn or reexamine Norton, where we've identified the liberty interest at stake as a fundamental right, then are you suggesting that we follow the procedures from our TPR cases where we've also said that it's a fundamental right?
I'm not sure that I understand.
Well, I guess I'm trying to be clear. If we're reluctant to re-examine Norton and identifying the liberty interest here as not being a fundamental right, and so if we're accepting that it's a fundamental right that we're dealing with here, then in TPR cases we have this the standard of a meaningful hearing test. So are you asking us to then adopt that type of standard and not use the Strickland standard?
I'll kind of split it off into
Fair
two
enough.
Parts. Okay. So if this court were to find that there's a fundamental right at issue, we should stay with strict scrutiny, that's fine. This court has also decided in that same decision that this act passes strict scrutiny. Certainly passes rational basis review, but it does already pass strict scrutiny as it's written. So without any more additions to the statute involving counsel, it passes as written. Now, So as to adopt...
But we didn't address the effectiveness issue in those cases, though.
No, Your Honor. And we've had the act around since 1999, and this is the first time that it's come up. So that should be some indication about the lack of ineffective assistance of counsel that goes on in these cases, because the CDU is very competent. And so we've already found that it passes strict scrutiny. But even if there is a fundamental right at issue, this court should not find that there's a constitutional claim. It would have to be strictly statutory. And even if it were statutory, Strickland would be inappropriate because of the termination of parental rights cases that did not adopt it. But even if it's, if this court were to recognize that there were a constitutional right, a fundamental right, and that we needed to have some sort of standard of review, I would agree it wouldn't be Strickland. It would be something lower, like the termination of parental rights cases. A meaningful review, I believe, is the standard.
And how would we go about doing that? If we didn't have a something like 24035 or 2915, how do we look at the record? Filing a motion for new trial clearly is not the way to raise it. You'd have to have some other counsel. You're saying it can't be appealed. What would be the mechanism for reviewing, assuming we were to adopt your TPR hearing standard?
Sure. So Minnesota actually has a unique procedure where they go through what our equivalent of like 7406, where it's essentially there was a mistake so egregious in the trial court that it needs reexamination. That's what Minnesota does. And I think that would be appropriate. It might allow for a hearing. It would be better than appeal. Habeas
who,
is always...
Who would hold the hearing? Where would the hearing, what kind of hearing? You're saying you would wait for habeas and raise it that way?
The 7406 proceeding would be held in the trial court.
Okay.
Habeas is another option. Habeas allows for evidentiary hearings and also would be held in the trial court if necessary.
And do you think you'd have a right to counsel at that hearing?
Well, that's another problem with this whole concept is where does the right to counsel begin and end? There's nothing in the legislature, what they've written, there's nothing that this court has set forth about this whole area. So we would have to figure out how to appoint counsel. We'd have to figure out whether the public defender's unit would be involved.
And those are all the reasons why opposing counsel suggests using the structure of 24035 and 2915 makes the most sense, because all those issues have been dealt with through those rules.
But again, that would require this court to enact an entirely new scheme that was not provided for before. I mean, it would be an extensive procedure to create new rules, think about who gets appointed, who gets the right to representation, indigent or not.
Absent the court rule, is there a constitutional right to counsel at post-conviction proceedings in the criminal case?
I see that I'm out of time. May I answer your question?
Would you please answer the question?
No, there is not. The right to counsel and post-conviction relief is limited, and this court has held multiple times that the claims of post-conviction ineffectiveness are categorically unreviewable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, could you give us a rough idea how many SVP trials your office handles in a year?
Trials, I would say, I'll also look to Ms. Dolan because she tries the cases and I don't try them anymore. About a 10 to 15, if there had been a stay for a while and we had a backlog and that was right before I went to appeals, I think about a dozen. So my office doesn't anticipate there would be any more than a dozen PCR claims to follow a direct appeal if that were expanded. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Well, are you saying you'd anticipate filing an ineffective assistance counsel claim in every SVP case where
no,
there's
sir.
A commitment?
But that, no, I don't anticipate it would be filed in every case, and I certainly hope that there wouldn't be an effective assistance in every case, but based on the number of appeals that I'm doing every year, we think there wouldn't be any more than that.
That's the maximum.
Yes. So the Kansas Supreme Court said it was difficult to conceive of a stronger liberty interest than the one involved in SVP commitment because it has the potential of being indefinite and it includes participation in sex offender treatment programs while committed to custody. This was a greater liberty interest than the prisoner's interest in VITEC because that prisoner would be, or someone subject to SVP proceedings would be free from state custody if it weren't for an SVP commitment. And I think that's significant when we're looking at the need for ineffective assistance of counsel claims. I think Florida has perhaps addressed this in the most successful way. They created one civil rule specific to SVP cases about how to raise these, and the rule directs that they are to follow the PCR rules in terms of when to bring in a collateral attack, what types of collateral attacks are cognizable, and to follow those procedures. It is done through a motion that is titled habeas, but it follows all of the PCR rules for the same reasons why we're asking this court to make the PCR rules applicable to these cases.
When you recommend expanding or adopting or incorporating the PCR rules, you would recommend starting it out in the little two-step about it starting as a pro se and then appointing counsel, you would recommend we incorporate that as well?
I think that's perfectly reasonable. I think since I am the only one doing SVP appeals for the public defender system, there's a substantial likelihood that I would refer it directly to a PCR attorney at my office if I were to have identified something. That's typically what we do anyway in our appellate practice. If we see something that we think warrants PCR relief, we would notify someone else to be on the lookout for that case. But I think we've seen that filing a Form 40 pro se has worked effectively for criminal defendants. I don't have any reason to believe it would not be equally as effective for my clients. If there are no further questions, I believe I'm out of time.
Thank you.